Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. If you can't say it, you can't do it.
Welcome to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I'm your host. My name is Franz. Well, it's December 29th, 2014, and it's snowing outside. It's snowing like crazy. In fact, it snowed a lot in the last week. Prior to that, when I did my previous podcast, there really hadn't been much snow, but man, it is coming down like crazy. I finally went skiing at Snowbird with my daughter the other day, and it was decent coverage. It was decent coverage. Sort of surprised me. So we have the holiday skiers out right now, and today it's overcast and cloudy, and I need to catch up on some projects at the office, particularly one I'm hoping some of my listeners will be interested in, is I did finish up the ASA 103, the Basic Cruising Certification audio lessons. There are 19 lessons, actually 20 files, because I have an introductory file as well. And it's available at $19.99 at this point in time. At some point in time, I may raise the price if I can get away with it. But I would rather get it out there in the market, get some feedback, see what I need to improve on, see if people appreciate it, see if it helps people in passing the ASA 103 written examination. I do have three lessons of varying length where I talk about my thoughts on your mental process in preparing for the on-the-water examination. Overall, it's over 9 hours of instruction. So I'm hoping there's a few of you out there that are interested in it. I will put a link to it in the notes to this episode and also at the website medsailor.com. I have a tab for, I think, sailing products or study products or something like that at the website. I'm not looking at the website right now, so I can't remember exactly how I titled it, but it's there somewhere. Neil Fletcher is handling my social media. He's been doing a good job. I'm slowly learning it. And I did follow quite a few people on Twitter that are involved in sailing. And also, I reached out to a man that does the sailing podcast. I think he's located in New Zealand or Australia, and I thought it would be good to cross-promote our podcast. Some of my listeners might be interested in his podcast, and vice versa. Haven't heard back from him yet. I hope to. Let's get on to the body of this podcast, and I'm not sure if you're interested in this or not. I like listening to stories. You can tell that. I like telling stories, and I like listening to stories, and one of my favorite characters is Spike Hampson. I did two interviews with him, at least a year ago, maybe more than a year ago. And I got quite a bit of feedback where people liked listening to his stories, but it has nothing to do with sailing in the Mediterranean. In fact, this is just about one man's adventure taking a small river boat, and his goal is to get it down to Buenos Aires, Argentina, starting in Wyoming. So in this interview, he starts out in Michigan and takes us up to finally getting into the Atlantic Ocean in Newfoundland. I think it's Newfoundland. Anyway, he goes out the St. Lawrence Seaway, but he has a great story to tell. But if you are only interested in listening about sailing stories, you can skip this one over. This has nothing to do with the Mediterranean or sailing, except Spike did say he just bought a sailboat. And you will hear him talk about that in the interview. So with no more ado, I'm going to do our quick two or three rules of the road questions. And these are pre-recorded, so I just drop them into. And right after that, we'll start into the interview. Thanks for listening. If you have comments, please feel free to contact me by just emailing me, Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, at medsailor.com. Or use the contact form at the website. I do like getting comments from listeners. Inland only. You have made your vessel up to a tow and are moving from a pier out into the main channel. Your engines are turning ahead. What whistle signal should you sound? A, one prolonged and two short blasts. B, three long blasts. C, one prolonged blast. C, one prolonged blast. D, five or more short rapid blasts. The answer is C, one prolonged blast. Inland rule only. Under inland navigation rules, what is the meaning of two short blast signals when used in meeting another vessel? A, I am turning to starboard. B, I am turning to port. C, I intend to leave you on my starboard side. D, I intend to leave you on my port side. The answer is C, I intend to leave you on my starboard side. The preferred method when meeting head-on is to pass port to port, and that would be one whistle signal. And one short whistle signal. Inland only. For purposes of the inland navigation rules, the term inland waters includes A, Western rivers, B, the Great Lakes on the United States side of the international boundary, C, harbors and rivers shoreward of the Colreg's demarcation line. And remember, Colregs are where the inland rules and the international rules separate, and D, all the above. And the answer is all the above. That's sort of a gimme question. This is Franz. I'm back with Spike Hampson. Spike, I interviewed a couple of years ago, and we posted the interview on a couple different websites, Travel Trade Exchange, and now it's being posted in Sailing in the Mediterranean. This has nothing to do with Sailing in the Mediterranean, but I had some good comments from listeners out there that enjoyed the interview, and I always like good stories, and Spike always has good stories to tell. Spike, all right. Let's just review the first part of the trip. You started
in the fall of 2004. Okay. I tried to start in Wyoming, and it was a bad choice. I had all sorts of problems, and I spent 1 week on a river, and I wasn't able to get anywhere. I ended up hauling the boat out of the water, storing it for the winter, and then starting again in the spring of 2005. Okay. And by the end of that first season, I had managed to get down the Yellowstone and the Missouri to the Mississippi and up the Illinois and into Lake Michigan through downtown Chicago and then up the Michigan State coast as far as Grand Haven. And that was by late September, and at that point I stored the boat for the winter and returned the following spring. Okay. But that was just the first of – that's a long time ago, 2006. And so I've been picking away at this project for a large number of years.
Well, that's where we left the last interview at, so we want to pick it up and get as far as we can get today with your adventure. Now, we can just tell everybody where you are right now, and we'll see how far we get to that location while we're here.
Well, just last week, I returned from Ponce in Puerto Rico. So the boat is now stored in Ponce, Puerto Rico. I plan to go back in about 5 months, but actually, I have bought a second boat, and so I now also have a sailboat down in Rockport, Texas, which is a strange place to have a sailboat. Not the place I would choose, but that was where I found the kind of boat I thought I wanted, and so I ended up buying it there. Now I got to find a way to get it out of there.
What kind of boat is it?
It's a Cape Dory 25D. It's a 25-foot Cape Dory sailboat.
I have a book called The Dory Book. Do you have that one?
No, I don't.
Okay. I have that book somewhere in my bookshelf that talks about dories and their construction. And they were originally from the Newfoundland area, weren't they? Weren't that where the
I don't know the history, but okay. I wouldn't be surprised if that were true. I'm very impressed with this boat. I think these Cape Dories are tough little guys.
What's it made out of?
It's fiberglass hull.
Fiberglass?
And it's 30 years old, or I guess it was 84 it was built. So, yeah, 30-year-old.
Well, they don't have keels, do they?
This one's a full-keeled
sailboat,
and it's really intended for passage making. And so I'm trying to become... I'm trying to get converted from the dark side, but it's a slow process.
So where do you want to put it when you move it? Are you going to move it by sea somewhere, or where are you going to go?
Well, one of the problems I have is that I make plans and then I change them all the time. And so no matter what my plan is, it usually ends up being somewhat different by the time arrives. But my plan last year, and I think I'm going to do it this year, is to head north. I love being in the tropics down in Puerto Rico, and the last few years I've been in the Bahamas and Turks and Caicos and Dominican Republic, and I like the exotic nature of it, but my constitution is not properly fitted for being in the tropics, and I just have no energy. I just don't do anything. I'm a slug all the time, and it drives me crazy. As soon as I come back north and return to Utah, go up to Connecticut to visit my daughter or something, I feel like I've just been let out of a box or something. I just have all kinds of energy that I didn't have before. So I'm thinking I should get one boat up in the north country.
So, thinking northeast or northwest?
I'm going to do a through the country trip to learn a bit more about the sailboat before I get out on the open ocean. So I'm going to go to Mobile, Alabama. That's not through the country. I'm going to go
up the
Gulf Coastal Waterway and some offshore stuff.
Tom Big Bay Waterway.
Tom Big Bay Waterway into the Tennessee River. And then I hope to go up the Ohio to around Pittsburgh. Have the boat hauled in Pittsburgh and taken to Lake Erie, at which point I'll need to take the mast down, and that will be when I'll replace the rigging. Because I think the rigging looks very good, the standing rigging, but it could be as old as the boat. And I think before I start sailing out in the open ocean, I better get the doggone rigging replaced. So I'll get the mast taken down, and then I'll motor up to the northeast end of Lake Erie and do the Erie Canal and go up through Lake Champlain to the St. Lawrence. And the idea would be to get up to, I don't know, Prince Edward Island or Newfoundland and leave the boat there and then return the following summer.
All that in 1 year?
No, it'll probably take me two,
three,
or three,
four,
or
five.
Who knows? I don't know. Yeah.
Well, that's going to be something else we get to talk about as time goes on. So
I hope so.
Let's go ahead and start where we left off at the end of the last interview in Grand Haven. You left your boat there, and that was in the...
This would have been late September of 2005.
Okay.
Right? And I returned in May of 2006 and spent a few weeks, as usual, trying to get the boat to run properly, and then headed north from there up to entry into Lake Huron.
So did you have any adventures on your way up the coast? That's a pretty, there's not a lot of places to duck into.
No, no, that's true. There aren't. But actually, there are enough places. Every 20, 30, 40 miles, there's some place you can get into, usually some estuary or something. And I had looked around quite a bit because that whole Lake Michigan is pretty bereft of good places. But I was lucky with weather, and I chose my days, and I didn't have any problem. I did have one or two pretty windy days, and I got some pretty good-sized waves on Lake Michigan that, for my little boat, seemed intimidating. But at that point in this whole venture, I was a very intimidated person by just about everything that I was that confronted me. I was scared to death, frankly. Yeah. But it was good experience for me.
So did you stop in Muskegon on your way up?
Yeah.
I'm just going along. I'm looking at Google Earth and sort of going along the coast. And
zoom out a little so I can get a little more oriented.
Okay.
Oh, Grand Haven. Yes, I did go into Muskegon. I spent a night in there. I don't remember it very well. I'm from Muskegon. No, I went into Whitehall.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I went into Whitehall on the first day, and... I just can't remember that experience so much. Was it like 30 miles, 20 miles?
Yeah, it's only about 20 miles. Okay, yeah. So that's why you would have skipped over Muskegon.
Yeah, it was so close.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went to Whitehall. Then from Whitehall, I went north up to
To Ludington.
Ludington, yeah, right inside that breakwater.
Ludington, Michigan, then. Okay, and that looks like a big area that you have plenty of room in there.
There was plenty of room. It was very nice. It was interesting because that day when I went up, it was very foggy. And when I was going up that stretch, somewhere along that coast, came looming out of the fog, this giant vessel up on stilts. And it was actually, it looked like a boat that was up on stilts, up out of the water, out offshore maybe, oh gosh, many hundreds of yards, maybe 500 yards offshore. I had no idea what this thing was, and since it emerged out of the fog, it was very mysterious especially. But apparently it was somehow associated with a water pumping scheme where they have water that comes down through a river and a weir that they can use to generate hydropower. But then during the low demand times, they pump water back up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't remember the details.
Was this an actual vessel that was moving through the water?
No, it wasn't. Oh, it was stationary, but it had some sort of a control device or mechanism or something. But anyway, it was a very strange thing, and I didn't know what to make of it. But it was very close to Ludington. I remember just after leaving that I was expecting Ludington to come into sight, and sure enough it did, but then the fog closed in, and I couldn't see it again. But finally got in, stayed in Ludington. That was uneventful and pleasant. It was nice. Nice time. And it was a typical routine on this coast is I'd get to a town or some place where I could get a little protection. I'd get the boat in by mid-afternoon and then haul out the bicycle and pedal around, take a look at the town. And that's been the routine for years, frankly, and it's great fun.
Okay, so... So you're working your way up, Ludington, then the next town up on the coast?
Well, I stopped in Leland. Would that be the next one?
Ludington, then you have Manistee.
Manistee.
Acadia, Frankfort. Oh, here we go.
Gosh.
No, Onekama?
I think I did go into Manistee, actually. But I'm chagrined. My memory is so poor now of the places I stopped. I've got to go back to the.
Okay, so it looks like Manistee would be the next place you could come into. Let's see how far that is. So from Ludington, your next stop would be about 20 miles away.
That would be a typical sort of crossing, yeah.
And then that would be transit. Manistee. I don't see any reason to go over every place you stopped on the coast. Just tell us what you remember, the best memories you have on sailing up in here, up in this area.
Well, I do remember when I got up to the top near the bridge. Just before Mackinac Island, there's the big bridge, and then just before the bridge, I was approaching the bridge, and the bridge is big. I don't know how many people have ever seen it or been across it, but it's really quite a remarkable structure. And, of course, the passage under the bridge is limited to a fairly confined section of the entire structure. And as I was aiming for it, a huge tanker came through. And I was terrified of tankers at that time because I thought they never would see me, and I didn't know for sure my engine was going to run right and I'd get hit. And so I was trying to avoid the tanker when I didn't even need to because it wasn't anywhere near to hit me, but I was just anxious all the time. But got across and underneath the bridge, and the tanker was long gone. And I do remember on the way up, over in this area, I stayed there. Yeah, Charlevoix,
okay.
So from there, the next day I went up to Mackinac Island. And the route north from there, I remember motoring across that. It was beautiful because I could use the big engine, and it was very flat, smooth water. It was easy. But I got about halfway there, and off in the distance, I saw a tanker, and I was so green at this point that I saw this tanker and I thought it was in trouble because it looked like it was flooded.
Because it was so low in the water.
It was so low in the water, but actually all I could see was the front of the superstructure and the back of the superstructure, and as I got closer, I thought I was a couple miles away. I must have been 6 or 7 miles away or some ridiculous distance, and I realized, oh no, it's just heavily laden and it's fine. So I cruised up to the top there, turned right, went under the bridge, and got to Mackinac Island. And Mackinac Island is a lovely place. I really enjoyed it there. It's not that one. It's
next.
It's the small one above it. That one there, I think, yeah.
I've sailed there on the Chicago Mackinac yacht race. And I really enjoyed it because it's an island that doesn't allow vehicles except emergency vehicles.
That's right. The speed limit is 20 miles an hour, right, mm-hmm. for whatever vehicles exist, which means that most snowmobiles could get tickets. And there are a lot of snowmobiles around there in the winter, I think. Yeah, yeah, it's a lovely town. And the hotel...
there's been some movies filmed at that hotel.
Grand Hotel.
Right.
Right. As a matter of fact, they show it as a regular thing. I sneaked in and I went in a back entrance to the hotel to get in and went to see the movie, which is really intended for the guests who stay at the hotel.
you party crashed.
I party crashed the Grand Hotel and watched the movie.
Well, I don't remember the name of it, but it was with...
I think it was Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, Christopher Reeve. Uh-huh. And it was a place in time.
Yeah, that's right.
That was the name of the movie.
Oh, geez. I wish I could remember these things. Everything is disappearing out of my head.
we better come in on a more more often than we're getting here. It's been several years since we've talked. So, okay, so from Mackinac. So how much you spent a bit of time on Mackinac?
I think maybe 3 days. I can't remember exactly, but I spent a little bit of time. And Lake Huron turned out to be a really wonderful place for me. I loved it. From Mackinac Island, I had a long day to get out to Drummond Island, which is the first one of that chain up there. Not that one there, yeah. And you see that big bay.
If you're looking at a map, it's the bay on the northwest side of the island there.
It's littered with islands. There are a whole bunch of little islands in that bay. And it's pristine. And I've spent a lot of time over the years casually looking at real estate in Drummond Island because I thought it was so nice there. But I spent some time in Drummond Island because I had a breakdown, one of many, with the boat. And it took over a week to get it sorted out. So
were you in the town of Drummond when you were working on it?
There's a little marina, and the town is so spread out. Yes, I was in the town, but that's deceptive because there is no real town. You can see from the look of that, there's a couple streets of things strung along them, and it runs off like a mile and a half, 2 miles away from the shore.
It's a good thing you had a bicycle.
Yes, it was. A bike was great. But actually, I was at that... Right at that marina you see there,
mm-hmm.
right at the end, yeah.
Okay.
Right in that place there. Finally got the problem resolved with the engine. And
now, what kind of engine was this?
Well,
was this the little engine or the
bigger? As a reminder, this is a 20 to 21 foot, at that point, it was an inboard-powered, jet-driven riverboat.
Right.
And the engine was a... Mazda rotary block that had been converted to marine use and supercharged.
Okay.
So it was powerful and light and noisy and inappropriate choice. But
at this point in time then?
It
was good for the river because...
It was good. The jet drive was good for the river. But if I were to do it over again, I would have shopped for a serious diesel engine that somehow could push a jet drive, you know, rather than having a gas engine. I no longer have that engine.
Oh, okay.
So that's a different story.
Well, we may or may not get to that story.
You might not. It's only 6-7 years away or something. But,
so you had to fix – was it the engine you had to fix then here?
Well, it's a part – it's not the distributor, but it functions somewhat like a distributor. And it was a part that was not readily available. It was a Bosch part that was produced only in Europe. And I had to get in touch with the guy who did the conversion of the engine. It was in Long Island, and he had to get the part for me. So it took a while to get this special part in.
I've always found when I've been stuck in a place, sometimes those are my best memories.
Oh, me too. Me too. I mean, it's all a matter of what attitude you adopt. Right? If you adopt the right attitude, I mean, why'd you go there? You went there so you could see it, so here's your chance, right? Yeah,
you're going to see it longer than you wanted to. So.
And there's actually, when I left there, there's actually one of these islands. Look at that island up there at the top.
Here, take the mouse there.
You see the island?
Turn it around so you're oriented right.
Right up here. Look at that bay. beautiful. You can go in that neck, and you can anchor. I anchored in there, and it was just, it's absolutely untouched.
This is Harbor Island.
Harbor Island, and you just go in through into that little bay, and it's just totally protected and pristine, and just a wonderful place.
Was there a lot of other sailors up there at the same time? It looks like it would be a very popular spot for boaters.
It probably is, but I was there very early. This was mid-May.
Okay.
And at that time of year in that country, that's pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, no, I saw very little in the way of other boat traffic until it got to the next month, well into June, before I saw much boat traffic, by which time I was over in Ontario.
Okay. Okay. So this is Lake Huron we're talking about, right?
This
now.
Is Lake Huron. And if you can zoom out.
Yeah, you want me just to can? Okay, let me zoom
out. You better run this thing. I'm pretty hopeless with this.
Okay.
If you zoom out, there's a string of islands, and you get this north channel to the north of them, and the body of the lake is to the south of the string of islands.
Okay.
And when you leave Drummond Island, you cross over into Ontario, and you have Cockburn Island there.
Uh-huh.
And then another little passage, and then the beginning of Manitoulin Island. And
that's a big island, too.
That's a very large island. It's I think it's the largest freshwater island in the world.
Okay. So did you go around that island on the south side or on the north side?
I went in the north side, and you can see that first notch up there on the upper left.
Right, between Clapperton
Island? No. Over at the far western end. Yeah, right. You see that little square?
Right, okay.
Not that one, the one to the left of it. That one, Meldrum Bay.
Okay, Meldrum Bay.
I had funny experiences getting to Meldrum Bay. One of the experiences, when I crossed between Cockburn Island and the end of Manitoulin, it's only about 2 miles across, I had pleasant conditions, I was well rested, it was a sunny day, there was nothing disruptive or disorienting or exhausting about what I was doing. It was just a day on the water, it was very pleasurable, and I looked off to the south through that passage between Cockburn and there's a huge suspension bridge there.
Right between Cockburn and this island.
And
here.
I watched this thing for 10 or 15 minutes. Now, I knew there was no bridge there. And there aren't even any people living on Cockburn Island. Well, I don't know, 100 people or something. And so there's no bridge there, but I was having a hallucination that would not go away. I could see this bridge. I could see the whole structure and all the wires that were supporting it and everything. And I wasn't sick. I wasn't tired. I wasn't disoriented or seasick or anything. I don't know what it was, but for some reason I just had this hallucination that there was this bridge running between those two pieces of land. And as surreal as that was, it was not as surreal as what happened to me when I got into Meldrum Bay, because there has to be a port of entry, right? Because I'm now in Canada.
Oh, so this is Canada up here now, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, we're now in Ontario. And so to get into there's a dock at Meldrum Bay. And Meldrum Bay is basically a stretch of road with about 10 houses scattered along it. One or two of them are actually doubling as businesses. So it's really a very small town with very little there, right? And it has a dock. You can see the dock right to the left of where that pointer is now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't remember that stone
jetty there.
Jetty there.
Okay.
But you can see the dock to the south.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's a little house out on that dock, and I pulled in and tied off at the dock and walked out to the end where there was a house. Now, it's not that building you saw in that picture. It was a very simple, basic house. But I was preoccupied with checking in, you know. I thought,
right,
I got to go through this process. And I hadn't done it before on the boat. And I thought, well, this is the first time. What are we going to do? So I go there, and it's quiet. There's nobody around. I don't see any people anywhere. Either on the dock, there are no boats around and no people around. And even on shore where the road passes by some houses, it all looks very quiet. Subsequently, I did find a couple people along the street, but basically it was so early in the season that hardly anybody was there. So I get to this little building out on the end of the dock, and it says Meldrum Bay, and it's a government sign.
Uh-huh. Right?
So this must be where I check in.
So is this a clear in port? Is it actually on their list of clear in ports? Because there's only a
few.
Yeah,
it is.
Is it?
It
okay,
is,
all right.
So I look at it, but there doesn't seem to be anybody there. And I see there's a door to go in, and I try the door, and it's unlocked. And I open it up, And when I walk in, there's nothing in there. Nothing except one piece of furniture. There's a table. No chair, just a table. And there's a phone on the table. That's all there is. There's nothing else.
No instructions, no nothing.
There's nobody there, nothing, right? And so I puzzle around and look at this file, and nobody's showing up. And so I finally just think, well, I'm going to pick up the phone and see what happens. And I pick up the phone, and it doesn't have the buzz tone of a phone when you pick it up. It's silent. And then after about 2 seconds, someone says, hello.
So that's how you cleared in, is that phone, huh?
Yeah. But then when I went to clear in, I said, hello, my name is such and such, and I'm on boat such and such, and I've just gotten to Meldrum Bay, and I'm trying to go through entry of the clearance procedure. And there's this hesitation. And after about 4 or 5 seconds, he says, we don't have a clearance port at Meldrum Bay. And I thought, then I hesitated. I didn't know what to say. I said, because I had read that there was one, and this building looked like it must be one. Uh-huh. And I was about to put the phone down and walk back out and check over the door to make sure this sign actually existed, right? But then I said, no, I saw that to myself. I said, yes, there is. There's a sign over the door. It says Meldrum Bay. There's another hesitation. And then he says, oh, you're right. And so then we go through the question and answer business, right? So they get all the information they want from me over the phone, which strikes me as a totally useless sort of procedure. I don't understand what the idea is behind this, aside from the fact that you can keep close tabs on all the honest people. Right. I guess that's all it is. But anyway, so I cleared through it.
So I got to ask you a question. Did they ask you if you had any produce on board? I used to go back and forth between Canada all the time in British Columbia and the U.S. up in Washington. And when I cross over to Canada, they would always ask me, first of all, they wanted to know if I had any alcohol on board, and of course I did. And they would always ask me, do you have any vegetables on board? And then they said, do you have any potatoes on board? And I said, usually I'd say no. But then when I'd clear back into the United States, they would say, do you have any potatoes on board? And I said, no. And I'd go through this every time, and that was always a common question they would ask me. Yeah. And so one time I asked the Canadians, I said, now, what's this thing about potatoes? They said, well, those nematodes out of the United States we've got to watch out for. We're trying to protect our potatoes from those nematodes down there.
So
I got the same answer when I got down to the U.S. side. So we have a potato war going on with Canada right now.
Got to keep out the exotic nematodes.
That's right.
The domestic ones are okay.
That's right. So you don't remember him asking you about potatoes, but I was just sort of curious about that. So
guns I remember, but I don't remember about produce.
Well, the other thing, my wife used to carry mace, and in Canada, mace is considered an offensive weapon, so they confiscated her mace.
Is that so?
Yeah. So anyway, so we had to give up her mace.
What would be a defensive weapon?
Well, I guess...
I mean, just abstract thinking.
I don't know. I mean, maybe a club or a knife. That's probably about all. But
amazing.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so you were able to clear in then.
So I cleared in. They said, "Yep, you're good to go. You're okay." And so I didn't have any documentation or anything, but they apparently had some electronic record of me being there. And I guess this guy I talked to must have been in Toronto or something. Okay. And they've just got a whole bunch of little isolated outposts scattered all around, and he coordinates it all. Okay. I suppose. I'm just speculating. I don't know.
What's the depth up there like? How deep are you anchoring when you're going up in these places?
I didn't anchor. I was,
you tied up in
I
this
tied
place.
At that dock, and then I went to Gore Bay, and I tied at a dock at Gore Bay. And then I went to Little Current. And once again, I was tied. But I don't know what the depth was like, although I have a depth finder, and I know that I had readings of depth, but I just don't recall what they were at the time.
So there's Gore Bay. So is that the next place?
Yeah, I stayed in Gore Bay the next day, and there's a little town there.
A little airport there, too.
Yeah. And then from there I went to Little Current, which is even farther east. Yeah.
Okay, so Little Current is that's a little narrow passage between, it looks like Birch Island and...
This is Manitoulin.
Manitoulin Island.
And I think that the other side is actually an extension of the mainland of Ontario.
Okay.
Right. But from this point on, the landscape in this upcoming area, Georgian Bay, is just stunning. unbelievable scenery. I have such vivid memories of this place because it's all glaciated rock.
Mm.
And if the forest is well enough developed, maybe you've got a 2-inch layer of soil with some trees growing on it. But in lots of places, it's just swales of rock. And it's all been rounded off by the continental glacier.
Uh-huh.
And as you get farther and farther over to the east into Georgian Bay, you get into an area where there are literally many thousands of islands of little rock outcroppings.
Hmm.
So if you go across, that town of Killarney actually is a magical place. You see it there. There's a channel through, and you can go through that channel and...
Looks like there's lots of places to tie off there.
Yeah, there are lots of places to tie off there. And it's a lovely little town. And then from there, going eastward, the landscape becomes...
So you're working your way up along the coast here through these thousands of little islands in here.
If you go even farther now, take an area like that and expand it, and you'll get... a multiplicity of islands appearing that don't even show up at present. Right? It is extremely treacherous. I can't think of anything worse than to be in this area during fog. I mean, you cannot. You're not going to find any soft landing anywhere. It's all just rock. But it's a wild, beautiful place. And in fact, I'd always had this desire to go to Georgian Bay because, as it happens, I went to university in Montreal. And while I was there, I got exposed to things Canadian. And one of the things that's most Canadian is the group of seven artists who, back in the late 1800s or early 1900s, were painting landscapes of parts of Canada. And they became sort of iconic Canadian artists. And there were two or three of the seven who really specialized on this Georgian Bay area. And they did all these paintings of the Georgian Bay region. I'd seen them in museums, and I'd always wanted to go there because I thought it looked so wild and appealing. And it was even better than their paintings. It was so impressive to me. I loved it. I was running through that area for about 4 days. From Killarney, I went through Georgian Bay, and it took me 5 days, something like that. So that's a very, very good memory for me, getting down to the east end of that Georgian Bay. Not the big, fat, round one, but the little one above it. Okay. Port Severn is the start of what's called the Trent Severn Waterway. And this is a canal that runs across Ontario and connects up the St. Lawrence with Lake Huron. Yeah. And this thing is fascinating because it was built back in the late 1800s, and Canada was serious about getting access to Lake Huron directly and cutting off the voyage through Erie and Ontario, shortening the trip. But this was a tough build because there's, I think, about 400 or 500 feet of elevation that has to be overcome, both going up and coming down. So you have to rise up to, 400 or 500 feet higher than the St. Lawrence and then drop back down 300 or 400 feet to get back down to Lake Huron.
So you took this route through here?
I took this route. And it's got some, I think it's 30 or 40 locks, about 40 locks in it. And the irony is that this whole thing, it took them so long to complete it, that it took them many decades to finish this waterway and the locks. And by the time they had completed it, shipping had completely outgrown the capacity for this system. It couldn't possibly accommodate the kinds of ships that would be commercial ships carrying produce. Right? So this Trent Severn Waterway languished for a number of decades and then became... they renovated it, restored it, refurbished it, and it's now a pleasure boater's paradise because it's a beautiful trip. These locks are fascinating because they have all kinds of oddities. For example, one of these locks that you go onto is actually a railroad track, runs up a hillside. So the railroad runs, the car for the railroad is operated by a pulley system, and the rail car is lowered down to the bottom end of the track, which is in the water. and the rail car has slings on it. And you power your boat over the slings. They tighten up the slings, and you are in a sling on top of a railroad car. And then they haul you up this hill on the railroad track and then go down on the other side into the upper canal.
How big a boat can go through this?
I can't. I would guess that you could get a boat that's close to 100 feet. Right?
So what sort of depth is through here? What's the draft that you can get through there? Could you get a five-foot draft sailboat through there?
I'm quite sure you... Oh, you mean through the Trent Severn? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I'm sure you can. Yeah. I don't think draft is an issue. Of course, I didn't pay much attention to draft because I don't have to deal with it, you know?
Right.
But I've seen a lot of boats in there, and I don't really think there's an issue of draft. And this waterway connects up a whole series of Ontario lakes, which are very picturesque. You can see it comes down to Lake Simcoe. I had more problems in Simcoe. I got stranded there for 10 days because of the outboard. The outboard went bad. I mean, I had to replace the lower unit on it and had to get it in. But then from Lake Simcoe, you can see off to the right, through that string of lakes, that's where the canal goes. Yeah, right, through there.
And I'm putting a track, and I'll save this picture so we'll upload it to the website that we're talking about here. Okay.
And another type of lock that they constructed that was really quite remarkable, and there were two of them in this system, was basically like a shoebox on a hydraulic post. Right.
Uh-huh.
So it would accommodate a boat, as I say, probably close to 80, 100 feet, something like that, at full length, right? So it's got a gate at both ends of the shoebox. And there are actually two of them, side by side.
And one would go up and
one would go
down.
And the way in which the shoebox would be moved up or down is by filling one of the shoeboxes a bit more than the other. Right? So mm-hmm. You put a little bit more in that water in that one, and that extra weight will then cause it to sink down when the other one is forced to rise up. And this kind of lock is interesting because there's actually no water motion. You go in there, they close the lock door, and there's no filling of water or draining of water. You're just in there, moved up to a new level or moved down to a new level, and then you're...
does it continue all the way across here?
Well, it now goes due south to Peterborough.
Oh, okay. Now you're coming down this
right here.
Now you
go down
here
to Peterborough. And then you're going to go back north again when you get south of Peterborough some distance, which has, incidentally, a wonderful canoe museum in it that shows the kinds of vessels that were used by the voyageurs. Gets up to Campbellton, heads back south towards...
This looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a great trip. And that's the end of it. So now you're right at the end of Lake Ontario, east end of Lake Ontario, ready to enter the St. Lawrence. Yeah, anybody who has a chance to should do this waterway. It is so picturesque. It's a beautiful, beautiful trip. And a lot of these locks are operated in the old-fashioned manner. They have people who walk around turnstiles to open and close the lock gates. Right?
Now, what is a charge? Did they charge you for going through this?
Yeah, but it's a fixed charge. Okay. I think it's like $40 or $60 for my boat or something. I don't remember, but it was a certain fixed charge. You buy the permit at one end, and you can go through to the other end, and you don't have to pay at each individual lock.
So you pretty much avoided all of Lake Huron, all of Lake Erie, and now you've come into Lake Ontario, and it looks to me like you're going to be going down the Erie Canal. Is that right?
No, I went out the St. Lawrence.
Oh, okay.
Right. So The reason I went out to St. Lawrence is that I had grown up in New Hampshire. And in subsequent years, after going to University of Montreal, I've traveled just about everywhere in North America. But in spite of that, I never happened to really visit the Maritime Provinces of Canada. And I always wanted to go there. That's just about the only region of North America I hadn't spent some time in. So I was determined I was going to go that way rather than go down the Erie Canal. I wanted to see the part of Canada I hadn't been to. So I went out the St. Lawrence and then over the top of Nova Scotia and then down the East Coast.
Now, that would, you would have to get used to a lot of ship traffic at that point in time, didn't you?
Yeah, but the ships didn't bother me nearly as much as the idea of the ocean. Right? That's true.
So were there any particular, was it uneventful going up through the St. Lawrence Seaway? Was that very pleasant as well? Or, so far, I'm getting the impression that this river trip from Georgian Bay over to Lake Ontario was really the highlight so far this year.
Well, actually, that Georgian Bay and that was great. But I have to tell you, everywhere I went that whole season, I just loved it, right? So going down the St. Lawrence, yeah, I had some interesting experiences. Down here, first of all, this whole business of clearing through from one country to another. When you come out of that canal and you're in Kingston, Ontario, and I headed up towards Gananoque, and I was going to go to Gananoque, and I said, no, I'm going to go over to Clayton in New York. Because there's a museum over there. There's a boat museum, and I want to see that boat museum. So I went over to Clayton, and as I'm on my way over, I think, oh, gosh, I guess I should clear through again, right? So I got there, and I stop at a dock, and the dock has got a little hut there, and there's a guy in the hut, and he says, oh, you can't clear in here. This is not the right place. It's over on the other side of the town, about a mile away or more on the water. And I said, oh, I don't want to move my boat. Can I just bicycle over there? And he said, yeah, you just go through the main street of town. You'll get over to that other place. So I go over there, and once again, there's nobody there. There's a little kiosk, and you're supposed to go into this kiosk and make a telephone call, and they take the information from you over the telephone, and they have a camera arrangement that takes a picture of you and takes a picture of your passport, you know. Mm-hmm. So I did that, then went back to my boat, and then went back over to the Canadian. So I'm going down the St. Lawrence, and that was a great experience because, of course, I had to go through these big locks. I mean, a lot of things happen, but let me see if I can figure out the things that might be most interesting. The locks that I had to go through are probably the biggest ones I've been in. They must have been 30-odd feet of elevation change. And the last one, just before Montreal, I had an interesting experience there because almost everywhere I went, people were just really, really nice. But in this particular case, I got a grumpy lockmaster, and he didn't like my behavior. I can't remember what I did, but oh, I know. I maneuvered my boat into an area I shouldn't have been in, right? And the directions on the board said to do such and such, and I had waited for half an hour, and nothing had happened to allow such and such, so I started to move, and then the loudspeaker notifies me this is not to be done. And so he's grumpy with me, and I've developed a bad attitude. But anyway, finally, someone else comes along who's going to go through the lock with me. It's a sailboat, and it turns out to be this French-Canadian couple, Serge and Joanne Robitaille are their names. And we get to know each other because we're hanging around waiting for the clearance. We're convinced that this guy is just putting us off because we're trouble, and so he's not going to take care of us. But eventually, we get in the lock, and we help each other and get through. And on the way through, he says, you know, we live right at the east end of Montreal Island, the west end of Montreal Island, and we have a yacht club there. Why don't you come and stay there the night? And I said, that'd be great. So I ended up spending the night in their yacht club, tied off, and then in not Senneville, not Bay Durfee, and go to Senneville and zoom in more on that area. I can't remember. Yeah, St. Anne de Bellevue. That's it. Somewhere in St. Anne de Bellevue, there's a yacht club. I don't see it. I can't remember it well enough to know where it was. But anyway, it was a very pleasant time, and I got to know this couple. He's a banker, and she was professional too, but I can't remember what she did. But they were over in Georgian Bay. They had their vacation, and they'd gone to Georgian Bay with their sailboat, and they'd been there for a week, and now they were making their way back home. And so that was the end of that, and I carried on, and then in subsequent years, we stayed in touch by email. Not much, maybe a couple times a year, we'd write a message to each other. And he told me he was thinking about quitting his job and getting a sailboat and sailing around the world. And so I encouraged this behavior. And a year or two more goes by, and eventually I get a message from him. He's done it. He's quit his job. He's found the sailboat he wants, and he and his wife are getting it ready, and they're going to take off in such and such amount of time. By which time I'm down in Florida or Bahamas or someplace, and I applaud their action. And no, I wasn't in the Bahamas. I was still working down the East Coast, and so that's kind of the last I heard of them. And so then this is now 5 or 6 years later. I cross over to the Bahamas, and I'm out in the Abacos and coming into Great Abaco Island. I can't remember the place, but there's a marina there, and I'm motoring into that marina. And there are all these boats anchored in this marina. And this black-hulled vessel has got this couple on it that's jumping up and down and waving and yelling at me. And I'm thinking they want to ride ashore. They want me to take them ashore. But that doesn't make any sense. How are they going to get back? I get over there, and it's them. And so they have actually got themselves organized, and they're now somewhere off in, I think they're probably in the Indian Ocean now. But
okay.
They had crossed the Pacific the last I knew.
All right. I'm going to stop. This interview, I'm going to stop. We'll start with another one in a second, but I'm going to stop this interview, this file, this point in time, and then we're going to start the recorder again for the next portion of it. So we've arrived now just at the outskirts of Montreal.
That's right.
And we're going to continue the story in the next podcast. Thanks for listening. Again, if you have any interest in learning to sail and you're studying for the ASA 101 or 103, I do have audio lessons that I put together. I just finished up the 103 audio lessons. They are available at the website. The 101 are for sale for, I think, $29. And the 103, the ASA 103, the basic coastal cruising, I have for sale at $19.99. I actually lowered the price, hoping to get more volume. We'll see if the supply and demand curve actually works. If you have any comments, feel free to contact me, Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, at medsailor.com, and the website is medsailor.com. All right, thanks for listening.
Joe, do you have something to tell me?
No, I don't think so.
I just got off the telephone with Bill Rutherford. Princeton can use a guy like Joe.
What?
Princeton can use a guy like Joe. His exact words.
That's unbelievable.
You're as good as in. I knew you could do it. Haven't I been telling you, every once in a while, you just gotta say, what the heck, and take some chances.
You are so right.
You made me very proud.
I was just thinking where we might be 10 years from now, you know?